You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Wednesday DMZ. We've not done Wednesday in a while.
I like a good Wednesday DMZ. I think a Wednesday morning is good for me. I usually do not have to write on Wednesdays. I feel like Wednesday mornings are kind of the sweet spot, but you're right. We normally tape Thursdays.
I like the middle of the week. It's kind of like, where am I in the week? Where's the week going? Enough has happened in the week that I wonder what's going to happen on the second, on the other side.
Wednesday has a feel.
Yeah.
You know, Tuesday doesn't have a feel. Wednesday has a feel, and it's a feel of not, it's not doneness. It's, it's hump day. That's what it is.
So the biggest thing happening in Republican circles is this blow up between Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene and Nancy Mace, which is fascinating to me because, you know, my view of midterms, and perhaps is a little tautological, that typically the president's party loses because when you're governing, the inherent trade-offs involved with governing splinter your majority coalition, and the opposition puts their differences aside to stay opposed to you. And that's why you get typically, you know, a reverse result from 2 years prior. And the question remained to me, can this be different because we're in a crisis, and crisis sometimes leads to a dynamic where the president's party is rewarded for managing that crisis. They stay unified in face of crisis, and the opposition splinters as a result. And after November, the obvious takeaway was, well, Democrats are not unifying now, so not unifying well enough to, you know, beat the odds. And Glenn Youngkin found a way to keep the Republican Party unified. So maybe they have a model for going forward, at least. And then a month later, here you are. Democrats have passed infrastructure, picking off some Republicans. And now Republicans are in, like, this totally idiotic, unnecessary circular firing squad because the Trumpist elements of the party just can't shut up.
Yeah. I'm not that interested in this in terms of how it's going to impact the midterms, partly because I think it's so far out. Mm-hmm. Remember, Ted Cruz did that silly government shutdown thing, and it didn't really have any impact on the next election because the next election was like a year away. So,
well, yeah, I mean, this one thing is not going to be what's on people's minds a year from now. The question, and maybe we should back up a little bit. What actually happened here? Because
right, why don't you brief us, Bill?
So basically,
get us up to speed.
Laura Boebert, who's rural Colorado congresswoman, first term, definitely in the Marjorie Taylor Greene camp as people looking to stir culture war more than legislate. See this as a glorified talk radio position, not really people trying to craft workable legislation. He's doing some event and referred to Ilhan Omar as being on the jihad squad and made some crack about, you know, worrying about her carrying a backpack to Congress. Boebert gives a bit of a half-assed apology afterwards. You know, if I offended anyone in the Muslim community, as if, like, maybe the rest of us are offended too, because it's generally an obnoxious thing to say. And then Nancy Mace, who is also first term, she's from coastal South Carolina. She beat a Democrat, Joe Cunningham. She's not in the Trumpiest of districts as it stands. Yeah.
And by the way, she is really oscillated.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes she sounds like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Boebert, and sometimes she sounds like I don't want to say Kinzinger, but
she's like a Lindsey Graham. She's like a Lindsey Graham. Knows,
I don't think she knows her brand yet. I don't think she knows what the brand is.
Well, I think she has a purple-ish district. I mean, I'm not saying that this is all insincere posturing, but I think I assume she has some pragmatic streaks inherently, and she's trying to, like a Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, where you're trying to balance that part of you with also enough nods to the hard right in your state or district so you don't get primary.
Yeah. Well, I can just tell you personally, there were moments where I thought, wow, maybe she's like going to be really good. And then she'll go mess it up and say something stupid, you know? So I don't have a lot of, I know in this story, she's sort of the hero, but I don't put a lot of stock in that.
Well, anyway, she's asked about Boebert's comments. Boebert? On CNN. Boebert. And she says something, you know, hardly, you know, I mean, you surely could have been a lot nastier to Boebert. But she said, so Mace on CNN this past Sunday said, "I have time after time condemned my colleagues on both sides of the aisle for racist tropes and remarks that I find disgusting, and this is no different than any others." So doesn't
so he... what I was going to say is I think that unfortunately we're now at a point too where like cable news channels are seen, fairly or not, as having political identities. And so if you are a Republican and you dare to say something critical of your own team, that's bad enough. But if you do it on CNN or MSNBC, that's even worse because it's seen as opposition media. It's seen as sort of like aiding and abetting.
It's going to the Soviet Union to criticize America. It's the Dixie that Chicks criticized George Bush in London.
That is actually a really apt analogy, Phil. That's why we have you right here. That's why you're in Cooperstown.
So then Marjorie Taylor Greene jumps in on Twitter to say Nancy Mace is the trash on the GOP conference, never attacked by Democrats or rhinos, same thing, because she's not conservative, she's pro-abort. Mace, you can back up off of Laura and Boebert, or you can just go hang with your real gal pals, the Jihad Squad. You're out of your league. And then she spells your Y-O-U-R, so Mace claps back
with
the proper spelling of your.
Yeah, we're making fun of the U-R. You missed one beat, which is did you mention that Boebert, so when Boebert issued like this semi apology, did you mention that Marjorie Taylor Greene said like you shouldn't apologize?
I missed that part. Sorry.
Oh yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene then criticized Boebert, saying like never apologize. You know, don't apologize to these people, for what that's worth. Right.
So, you know, Mace claps back, says, "While I'm correcting you, I'm a pro-life fiscal conservative who was attacked by the left all weekend, as I often am, as I defied China while in Taiwan. What I'm not is a religious bigot or racist. You might want to try that over there in your little league," quote-unquote. Then she threw another tweet saying, using emojis, this is what batshit crazy looks like. and so this is just going on and on between the two of them. And it just seemed...
And let me say with Nancy Mace, and later Nancy Mace used the F word in regards to Marjorie Taylor Greene. I forget the context, but maybe she's effing crazy or whatever.
I mean, she should have said, "Let's go, Brandon." That's the appropriate use of the F word in conservative circles.
But the thing is, Nancy Mace, it's sort of like when Rubio tried to fight with Trump, you know, like. Nancy Mace in this story is sort of the adult in a sense, but she is also engaged. You know, she is engaging in kind of wrestling in the mud as well.
Well, I am fascinated that Mace is leaning in.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not surprising that Green would stir this pot, although a more rational public would say, "Hey, let Mace say what she's in CNN. Who cares? We got Democrats on the run right now. So we don't need to cause intra-party warfare unnecessarily here. But obviously, Green is thinking more about herself and her brand than she is about party politics. But as you noted before, Mace has walked a fine line here. You know, this is the most overt she has been in pushing back on the fringe element in the Republican Party. I mean, you can't walk this back. I mean, she will never be seen as just a simple, plain conservative after this. So she's really planting her turf, and she'll have to own that. I mean, and it might well be good enough in her district. I mean, I don't know where her lines are being redrawn, or if she'll, or I'm sorry, I don't know this in advance. If South Carolina has done its redraw, maybe she'll get punished for this and get a Trumpy redraw. I don't know. But she is, this is a pretty bold move on her part to escalate this fight to this level.
I don't know. I think she'll try to be Trumpy again. Like, that's the problem I have with Nancy Mace, is that she tries to kind of be all things to all people. And she'll, like, in fact, there's a video of her where, like, she went on CNN and was talking about, like, the importance of, like, masking and getting vaccinated. And then there's a video of her, like, on Fox talking about, you know, like, kind of making, like, we all know that natural immunity is way more effective than vaccinations and, you know, antibodies that you get. Like, so, I mean, I'm not saying that she's completely contradicting herself and saying opposite things, but, like, she's really trying to, like, have her cake and eat it, too. She's trying to, like...
Well, Graham has always done this, and Graham has survived by doing that. So I'm not saying she can't survive.
Yeah.
But amongst, you know, wired in conservatives, they will never fully trust Lindsey Graham, and they're never going to fully trust Nancy Mace now.
That may be. I will say, the obvious other point here is, A, this is hard. Our country's in deep trouble. Like, this is so damaging. You know, we have elected members of Congress who are really like high school girls. I mean, this is like Mean Girls.
I don't think you have to gender this, because we see plenty of boys
do the same thing. I criticize them too, but we're talking about, I mean, you've got the squad are four women, and now you've got this thing with Nancy. Now, look, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene said some of her things on Matt Gaetz's podcast. Okay.
So maybe Paul Gosar went down this road too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a problem in our politics that is for men and women, and it's bipartisan, but this is childish and it's high school behavior. And the incentives encourage this. And I think that, you know, part of what we're seeing is obviously people like Boebert and Green are trying to, like, they're punching up in a sense. They're trying to, like, use Omar and AOC as a foil for them to get, you know, for the Republican Mean Girls to get attention and publicity and buzz, right?
Well, it was Star Trek VI when, like, the warmongering faction of the Federation teamed up with the Klingons to try to spark intergalactic war and not have a peace agreement. I mean, they feed off each other. But I think it's a mistake to treat, you know, that spectacle, you know, that that, like, Roman arena, you know, gladiator battle as being the main show, because we just passed an infrastructure bill, bipartisan infrastructure bill. Schumer and McConnell are having very civil conversations about raising the debt limit. We had our Bill Maher conversation last week. I don't want to go through the whole Bill Maher thing all over again, but I did have a piece in the Washington Monthly about this. You know, he had this whole rant about, you know, Democrats are being destroyed by wokeness, and he cites, you know, six Democrats voted against the infrastructure bill. You know, here's why Democrats aren't seen as beloved by the middle class because you have these six Democrats who vote against it. I'm like, dude, you have 265 Democrats in the House and Senate that voted for it. Why are you taking the six and making them define the party? You know, we don't have to, none of these people have to define the party if we don't let them. And so it's interesting that Nancy Mace is taking a leadership role here, even if she's doing it in perhaps a bit of a high school way. She is saying, look, I'm not going to let these people define my party. There are people trying to push back against it.
I think you've given her too much credit. I don't think Nancy Mace had a proactive strategy to police the right and take back her party. I think she went on TV to get attention. She was on CNN, where the popular path of least resistance would be to say what she said. She said it just so happened to be the right thing at the moment. She said the right thing, but she probably wouldn't have said it if she was on Fox. So she's on CNN, says the right thing. Then she gets dinged by Marjorie Taylor Greene. Now, what do you do? Do you back down from a fight and look weak? Do you punch back? I think that she basically got sucked into this fight. I don't think that she was like out there trying to do good and like change the party.
But when the fight came to her, she embraced it. I mean, I agree she didn't go on CNN trying to stir this up, but once it came to her, she was right there and ready for it and saying, "Look, I'm not going to be pushed around by these people."
Yeah. If a week or two from now she's still fighting the good fight and standing up and saying the things she said, I'll be on the bandwagon, but I'm skeptical.
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to elevate any of these people as being heroes. But I do think, I mean, if you're a Republican who wants a return to sanity, like Glenn Youngkin, you know, he flirted with Trumpers. He didn't like give him a beat down. But he did keep them at an arm's length so he could be seen by the broad swath of the middle of Virginia as a normal person. There is some rumbling here in the Republican Party saying, look, we can't be defined by Trumpers because it's not who we are, not who I am personally, not who we are as a party, not what we think is sustainable for us going forward. So the fact that some people are doing this, we're talking about incentives. Some people are seeing the incentive for getting past this type of extremist behavior because it will drag the party down to the abyss. They can't survive being this way forever.
So I'm going to go back to something you said a second ago, though. I mean, Bill, you're making the point that the vast majority of Republicans and Democrats are not Marjorie Taylor Greene, not Ilhan Omar.
Well, at least in terms of Republicans, I don't want to be that glib about it. I think most people who are elected Republicans are not in that camp. I don't want to be in that camp, if all things being equal. Whether the rank and file level of the Republicans is maybe another matter.
But the point I would make is, and I think you're right, but I also think it's kind of irrelevant because if you've got Marjorie Taylor Greene and Boebert and AOC and Omar and Tlaib, and they're generating a disproportionate amount of buzz and attention, and they're driving news cycles, right? Because there's an incentive to cover conflict and controversy and all that, then I think in a way it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in a sense. Like, it doesn't matter that they're in the minority. They're driving the discussion, therefore they are relevant. It doesn't matter that it's a small group. And, you know, small groups of people historically have punched above their weight in terms of...
They're certainly punching above their weight in terms of the amount of attention that they're getting and their ability to, you know, commandeer the news cycle. But, you know, so if from a Democrat perspective, again, I think one, as a matter of good policy, you want to find your bipartisan openings because those are the bills that are going to have the most shelf life. They may not be the best policies. I'm not saying that means you get the you get perfect policies that way. But if everything is partisan, the pendulum will keep swinging and they'll get passed, repealed, and that's not stable. So you get more stability if you can find where the common ground is. So I think Democrats should be looking for that common ground. As a political matter, again, Democrat unity plus Republican disunity is the way to maintain power, particularly in a midterm when those dynamics are not usually prevalent. If there is just a faction, a small faction of Republicans, like, we can't have Baybird and Green defining us, it's going to kill us. Democrats, if you can give me just something halfway decent to work with, I'll come over just to make sure I'm not being tarred with this insanity. I mean, that happened with infrastructure. I mean, you can say just barely, you can say just 19 senators and just 13 House Republicans, but that was enough to get the bill passed, enough to make Trump mad, enough to stick it, I think, Taylor Greene's craw that she wants to have these sorts of fights. You know, the problem for 2022 is it's not obvious what the next thing is. No one's really queued up the next round of bipartisan successes. But I think there could be things to pursue if people, you know, stand up and actively pursue them. And the more the Republican infighting there is, I think the more opportunity there will be to find 10 senators and a handful of House Republicans saying, look, we need to be adults here.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm just, you know, I'm so just depressed about the state of things. And like, you know, when things like this happens, I mean, I'm to the point where, like, I think if I could do anything else, I probably would. I have no talents. I can't build anything. I can't, you know, so to the degree that I've had any success in this business, it's been because I can't, you know, because I've got nowhere else to go, as Richard Gere might say. But it's a depressing state of affairs. This is not what I signed up for. I did not get involved in this, you know, when I was a kid, loving politics and being excited by politics. This is not what I had in mind.
From a selfish, craven business standpoint, you have a lot to talk about when Republicans are in disarray. Because you're saying the same about
is, it. The problem is that it's gotten so... So, like, let's say that you're an NFL. I'm on a kick of using football metaphors for some reason. Let's say that you're like a football analyst, and you have like a real philosophy, like you believe that you should run the ball, and like, you know, and you've had some success. You can sort of talk about that. You've got something to talk about, and you could show cite examples. But like, what if they decide to change the game, and now it's like 200 yards, and there's seven downs, and you know what I mean? Like at some point, all the wisdom that you've accrued about how to play the game is out the window, and nobody will listen. You know, the fans don't want to listen. The coaches have decided that's old fashioned. Like we are now at a, you know, I think we've gotten to a point where it's hard to think that anything matters.
Well, like, I've long given up on people listening. I don't write anymore thinking someone's going to listen to me and they're going to change their ways. So I think once you get over that ridiculous fantasy,
yeah,
and you realize the best you can do is write for an audience that, I mean, what I think I can do, I apologize to the DMZers for, you know, hardcore navel gazing. But if I can help people understand politics better, they can make better decisions with what they do with their activism or their donations or their decisions to run for office or whatever. I know I'm not going to change the whole game. I'm not going to overhaul the system by doing this. But I do think I think there is value in understanding how these things work better to better manage expectations, to avoid frustration, demoralization, and cynicism. Yeah. But that's that keeps me going. So,
well, you know, this would be a totally navel-gazy thing, but I think there's got to be people who do what we do who've become like very demoralized and burned out, right, because of the Trump era and the now with the I'm covering like Boebert and Marjorie Taylor. It's laughable that this is depressing. Like, if you care about democracy, and the health of democracy, then covering politics today is sort of like covering like a mass shooting every day or some sort of tragedy, you know? And Bill, you know, look, I know there's some people who think that because politics is so important, that you shouldn't view it as a hobby, you know, it shouldn't be fun because these are issues that have to do with, you know, morality and politics is important, but it also used to kind of be fun. And it's so often like sad now. You know, you can laugh at some of the stuff going on, but it's so serious. So
Well, I think it's all going to be okay very soon, because we have a white knight, we have a savior in Dr. Oz. Dr. Oz is coming.
Yes,
to fix the Republican Party.
I'm starting to sense a common thread throughout this episode, Bill, but go ahead.
You don't feel like Dr. Oz is going to, you know, the guy who doesn't even live in Pennsylvania, who's like glomming on like his parents' house for his residential address. Isn't he going to be the one that takes back the Senate for Republicans and throttles the Biden administration and queues up a Trump resurgence in 2024 and everything's going to be okay?
Well, he could win. I mean, I think that much is true, Bill. You know, just putting on the political analyst hat, do you agree that he at least has a shot?
I mean, after Trump, you can't discount anybody, but I would think he would have a hard time in a primary. I don't know. You know, Sean Parnell bowed out. He was the former before he got caught up in allegations of domestic abuse. I don't know who else is in the Republican field right now, or if it's even fully settled yet. So I can't speak, you know, that intelligently about it. But I do think that it is hard for people who've had no engagement with the actual voters of that state to win elections. I mean there obviously are certain examples of outsiders, you know, barnstorming in and on a wave of media love.
Hillary Clinton in New York.
Well, but I was in a little Twitter exchange because me and a couple of the reporters were like announcing your Pennsylvania Senate campaign in the Washington Examiner when you already have a carpetbagger issue hanging over your head seems stupid. And then someone was like, well, you didn't say this about Hillary in 2000 when she ran for Senate. And, you know, number one, I wasn't a professional political writer 20 years ago. But, you know, Hillary Clinton was acutely aware that she was very vulnerable to a carpetbagger charge. And she did this multi-week listening tour before she announced to try to say, hey, I'm part of the state. I'm admitting I don't know everything about this state. I want to learn from you about this state. I want to build these bonds with you and then make my decision. And you could say, that's obvious bullshit.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, she did it. She went through those motions.
At least go through the motions and do the work.
Yeah. And it worked. You know, she was able to pull it off. And of course, in New York being a very blue state. So like once you can, if you can clear the primary field, I don't remember if she had a primary challenger, if she cleared that field ahead of time. And once she did that, the Senate, not that Republicans haven't won Senate races, because they did used to do better in New York at the time, Al D'Amato and whatnot, but still was still a blue leaning state. So the hard part was getting through the primary. Pennsylvania is not a hard red state. It's a purple state. So he's got two big challenges to worry about. And if there's some other Pennsylvania Republican who's got better grassroots bona fides, that puts Oz at a disadvantage. So maybe he'll do the things he needs to do to build those bonds. And it could well be that we are so far removed from all politics as local that the Pennsylvania Republican primary electorate just wants someone who's going to, you know, drive the media bonkers. And that's good enough for them. I mean, I'm not on the ground well enough to be able to say that confidently that that's not the case. But I certainly wouldn't put all my chips on it.
Yeah.
And
he's going to have money. He's going to have name ID. You know, he sort of looks the part of a politician. He's a doctor.
You know, every time I see him, I think Jason Bateman in Arrested Development. I can't separate the two.
That's a good look. Jason Bateman's a good looking guy. So he's a doctor. No, again, you could say that's like
Ben Carson was a doctor, and you know, he only took it so far.
So, but anyway, I mean, it seems to me like he has a shot. Now, who will he likely face in the general?
Well, every time I talk about Pennsylvania, this is a fascinating thing about sort of me and the Twitter sphere. I've brought up John Fetterman a lot.
This is the guy who's like super big.
He's like 6'6", big bulky guy. He's got tattooed arms. He was mayor of Braddock, which is a Western Pennsylvania, you know, hardscrabble city. And so he has this sort of vibe as true blue collar Pennsylvania, though he does come from, you know, wealthier stock. He's pretty Bernie-ish in his politics. He's very big on legalizing marijuana. He hates the filibuster. Fetterman's just a good copy. He's an interesting guy. He's a character. So he's fun to talk about, number one. And number two, I think he has a leg up over Connor Lamb. And these aren't the only two candidates, mind you. There's an African-American guy named Malcolm Kenyatta. So he could well have a shot at this too. And I think a few other lesser names. But Fetterman and Lamb could talk about the most. And every time I bring up Fetterman, I get people yelling at me in my feed that I'm disrespecting Connor Lamb. And it's like, where did this moderate Twitter sphere come from? And why are you yelling at me all of a sudden? And I don't discount Connor Lamb, but I do think Fetterman has a leg up here. And polling backs this up. He's a statewide official. He's run statewide before. He ran statewide twice. He had a losing Senate primary campaign, and he won lieutenant governor. So he's got the name ID. He's got more networks. He's got more personal relationships. Connor Lamb, I've argued many, many times that the moderate candidate often has a leg up over the progressive candidate in Democratic primaries, depending on the exact place. But we've seen this in congressional races, Senate races, mayoral races, governor's races. That's generally true, but Connor Lamb is a congressperson who's never run statewide before. So I think he has a name ID issue and a personal relationship issue. I mean, not that it's not surmountable, but I don't think Fetterman is the usual left-wing candidate. He's got a brand and a style that's very effective. And I think he's not Dennis Kucinich, you know, he's more interesting than that. And so I think Lamb is running uphill right now. I mean, not that he can't win, but I would still lean towards Fetterman winning this primary as it stands. And if it is Fetterman v. Oz, that is one marquee Senate matchup.
Yeah, it could be a really interesting race in Pennsylvania. And you know, the other thing too, Bill, is it seems like, no, look, I know Dr. Oz is not an A-list celebrity. He's not Tom Cruise, okay?
Well, not, but Ronald Reagan also wasn't A-list either.
But he's also not, he's not Pat Boone.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it seems to me like the GOP is starting to attract more celebrities, like for better or worse. Someone like Dr. Oz, I think in the old days would have been, if he got involved in politics, it would have been as a Democrat. You know, there's, you know, the Republican Party in the Trump era has, and probably because it's shed a lot of the social conservative stuff, it's become more of a party, I think, that, I mean, it's become much more of a vulgar party, but it's also become a party that is attracting, you know, among other groups, more, maybe more celebrities. What do you think?
I mean, like, there always were Republican celebrities. I mean, there's Ronald Reagan, of course. There's Fred Dalton Thompson. There's Sonny Bono. Athletes.
Charlton Heston.
Yeah, well, he didn't run. You know, he's really, but like J.C. Watch, Jack Kemp. You know, there always were athletes and a certain kind of conservative, you know, movie star celebrity that were comfortable being Republicans. Jim Bunning, another athlete. What I think is a little different now, perhaps, is the amount of, you know, maybe the amount of dues being paid. Like Sonny Bono was a mayor, Clint Eastwood was a mayor, Jesse Ventura didn't run as a Republican, but he was a mayor. Mm-hmm. I forget what Jack Kemp did before he was a congressperson, if he did anything else in between running. But see, running for Congress still is like
Kemp, I think right after football, he got, I think he like did something like in politics. Like, I think he might have interned or something.
Maybe. I mean, something, you know. But the notion of being like just a celebrity and doing nothing else and then running for a big job, governor, senator, president. You know, that might be a little more unusual here.
Yeah.
And you know, just like with Herschel Walker in Georgia, I mean, I don't know if Republicans are going to embrace Oz as quickly as they're embracing Walker. You're embracing people who haven't even tried politics yet. Like, you have no idea how good they are on the stump. Like, this is just the big nuts and bolts of being a candidate. You are taking a total flyer on these people.
So like Schwarzenegger, for example, and then Schwarzenegger really undermines my argument. But Schwarzenegger, I remember like he went out and campaigned for George H.W. Bush, and he said like Michael Dukakis would be the real Terminator, you know, things like that.
With girly man, all that stuff.
And he was married to Maria Shriver, obviously part of the Kennedy clan.
He was also on Bush's Council of Physical Fitness, which is not like the most glorified political thing, but he was doing things to familiarize himself with the political world.
Yeah.
And he teased running for a long time. It was in the air for a while. So when he made the jump, it wasn't so jarring and sudden. And I think he was prepared for what the trail involved. Maybe Oz has done this preparation. We just haven't seen it yet. But if you're in the party infrastructure, and more in the case of Herschel Walker, who has a much more, some darker stuff in his bio to overcome. Like, you just don't know how good they are in dealing with these things. Like, curveballs are going to be thrown at these people. You just don't know how they're going to be able to handle that. And you're flying blind at this point.
Now, what I think is interesting is the people who turn to Republican politics after they've exhausted all their options. I mean, like, Sonny Bono was not at the peak of his career when he became mayor of Palm Springs or whatever, and then became a congressman.
Same with Reagan, and arguably same with Schwarzenegger.
Right. Well, I think Schwarzenegger was still, he wasn't in his prime, but I think he was still pretty relevant, still a bankable commodity. But yeah, it tends to be people like, you know, after they retire from baseball, after they retire from football. But Dr. Oz, I mean, I don't know, like, part of my problem is like, just like I never saw Donald Trump's TV show, I've never actually seen the Dr. Oz TV show, because like, why would I be watching that crap? But apparently it would be really beneficial to my, you know, political punditry if I watch stuff like that. But it seems like he's still relevant. Like, he is doing, he could still be out there doing.
Oh, yeah, I see his mug every time I go to the grocery store on some glossy magazine thing. He has all these different, you know, how to live your best life, how to eat properly type stuff, you know, on the checkout aisle.
Yeah.
He's not past his prime as far as being a media figure is concerned.
So, I mean, I think that is interesting because a lot of these people were like, well, I'm 50 years old. I can't pitch anymore. So I might as well run for office. It's sort of like grasping at something. Whereas with Dr. Oz, and I think Donald Trump too, I mean, you know, wasn't Trump still making those shows? Didn't he have to like leave that to run? Maybe I'm wrong.
The Apprentice.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was in the, there was some talk. I mean,
it was Howard, like Celebrity Apprentice or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But he could have kept milking that if he wanted to.
Mm-hmm. For what it's worth. I mean, I don't know. I think that's a shift maybe from the old days where like, it's sort of like people only find Jesus when they're in jail. People only find the Republican Party. Like why, you know, and I realize 9/11, what I'm about to say isn't completely fair because I think 9/11 changed things, but like it would have been real nice if Dennis Miller had been promoting conservatism when he was on Saturday Night Live or Victoria Jackson or go down the list. Like they're never as a conservative, it was always like it was never the person who was actually in their prime who was relevant who was promoting conservatism. That was like what they discovered after they needed a second act or something. But in the case of Dr. Oz, he is still relevant.
I know you got to jump soon, but is there anything else you want to talk about before we call it a week?
Well, no. There's all things we could talk about. The Dobbs case is as we're speaking, it's going to be argued today. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything new for us to say yet. Except that it could be a big deal, obviously. Mm-hmm. There's the whole Chris Cuomo dust up over at CNN. Mm-hmm. Probably best that I not weigh in. Although I would just say I always nice to me for what that's worth, which is not much. But I think the main thing I want to say, Bill, is that at least according, you know, knock on wood, according to my schedule, we will be back in the DM Zoom later this week, right?
Our Fridays align, correct?
We have scheduled for now, good Lord willing, a DM Zoom call with our Patreon supporters this week. This will be the first time in like a month that we've done this, Bill.
That's right. Which is all your fault.
I'm going to take 60% of the time.
But all is well in the world. The DM Zoom is back. So those of you who haven't had the chance to be part of the mix, you know, all you got to do is chip in to one of our Patreons. It's going to be as little as a dollar. For the cost of a cup of coffee, you can be on the DM Zoom and have a rarefied conversation with the leading lights in American political punditry. One thing to note quick, the report here in Massachusetts that Charlie Baker is not running for re-election. So tectonic plates are shifting. You know, Pat Lay not running in Senate in Vermont.
Baker is the governor.
Yeah.
Republican.
Yeah. One of the most popular governors in the country.
Wildly popular, right?
Yep.
And
now his numbers have sagged recently with the pandemic. So again, we talk about Biden's numbers being hit hard by the pandemic. I don't think it's unique to Biden. I think all people in power, there's a frustration with the pandemic that people in power are getting tagged with, and particularly amongst Massachusetts Republicans, of which there aren't that many, of course. They are looking at Baker much more like a Democrat. Like they're not enamored with him. They're not thankful that they have the chair of the governor in Massachusetts. What's this good for if he's not going to be a Trumper? If he's going to act like a regular Democrat with his vaccine mandates? So there's been a little bit of polling because he has a primary. He would have a primary challenger, who and he was losing the primary in a couple polls.
Wow.
Right, Baker wins not because there's a lot of Massachusetts Republicans. He wins because he gets the votes of the unenrolled independents and some Democrats. He hasn't had a real primary challenge. He had nominal ones before. And he said yesterday or Monday that he wasn't going to run as an independent, which he, if he did, he probably could win. But he said he wasn't going to do that. And if the rumors...
How many terms has he had?
The two.
You know, he's had two terms.
My sense of him, and I'm not saying I'm not a fly on the wall, of course, but you know, he didn't have any elected positions before. He had some executive branch appointed posts, and he was CEO of a healthcare company. I never got the vibe from him that he was like in this forever. They want to be governor forever, and this whole identity was wrapped up in it. I mean, 8 years, leave on top, have a nice life, strikes me as a logical trajectory for him.
That's the way it ought to be, honestly. I think that's what the founders envisioned. And you shouldn't define yourself. It's so sad, people who, they can't give it up, man. They can't leave, you know?
But the interesting question for Republicans is, now, I mean, here's a guy, I mean, in a reasonable, rational world, this guy would be a golden presidential candidate. Here's a guy who can maybe pick off a few blue states and lead you to the promised land, but he's a social liberal. He's pro-choice. You couldn't necessarily trust him on judges to overturn Roe, though it might be overturned by the time he gets there. No one thinks he could win a presidential primary, and it'd be hard for him to win a Senate race. Like it was hard for Bill Weld to win a Senate race and hard for Scott Brown to win a Senate race when it wasn't a special. So he's probably going off into the sunset, even though Republicans should be like begging for him to be like the face of their party.
Well, there's always Larry Hogan.
Well, and Glenn Youngkin also could be someone who gets looked upon for as a national candidate. But this, we have a history now of Republicans dominating New England governor's seats. But it's starting to weaken because you lost Maine. Paula Page, you know, couldn't hold on. And now you might lose Massachusetts. So, I mean, Massachusetts, I can't tell you that they won't keep it because his lieutenant governor, Polito, could well get elevated. But the Democrats have a pretty strong potential candidate in Maura Healey, who's the AG. AGs have a pretty fraught history of getting elevated in Massachusetts. But she has yet to be tagged with any kind of big controversy or scandal. And I think the assumption is that she would run if Baker didn't. She hasn't announced yet, but my guess is she will announce soon now. And she'd probably be tough to beat in the primary, and could well be very strong in a general. You certainly can't count on that. But if it is the case that she does become governor, or some Democrat becomes governor, is the life of the New England Republican moderate governor seeing its last days?
All right, everybody. And on that note, follow us at DMZ Show on Twitter. Bill, everyone should check out my YouTube page, of course.
You're killing on YouTube.
YouTube.com/Matt Lewis. What do you want to plug?
Well, I got my Bill Maher piece in the monthly. That's up. I'm working on a piece. It's actually a Virginia governor's race CODA piece. I'm just teasing it right now. But I was in the staff meeting yesterday. I was like, I don't know about this one. It's been a month. Maybe it's stay on there. And when I laid out, they're like, oh, no one's ever. I didn't know that. Oh, that's interesting. You should do that. So it's going to be something about Virginia that you don't know about. And hasn't been talked about before. So keep an eye out for that.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing I want to plug real quick, I saw that movie about, I think it's called King Richard. It's about Serena and Venus Williams's father.
Yeah.
Starring Will Smith. It was amazingly good. Have you seen the trailer, Bill?
I think I saw the trailer at one point. I've been dipping into Get Back on Disney Plus.
Oh, yeah.
Have you watched that yet?
No, I haven't seen the whole thing, but
Maybe we should see the whole thing for next week. Talk about it next week.
I don't know if I'm going to see the whole thing, but I did see the clip of you know, Paul McCartney kind of on the spot coming up with the song Get Back.
See, I'm not blown away by that. I mean, I was like, wow, that's how Get Back happened. I'm like, this is why I don't really like Get Back. This is why I'm a Beatles guy, but I don't really care for the last couple albums. I mean, they're not all bad, but they're not the ones I get the most excited about. I'm like, yeah, you half-assed this really basic rock song because you were struggling to come up with material. which is interesting to me, but I'm not like amazed that's how that song got created.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fun to have the footage to be able to see the conception of the song that went on to become a big hit.
Absolutely.
And you know, Yoko's there like knitting or reading the newspaper and like so. But King, I will say, probably not going to watch the whole Get Back thing. Do recommend, highly recommend King Richard. Although, you know, he was a very complicated dude. And the movie shows that he was a difficult, weird guy. But I think that I've seen some of his children from previous marriages or relationships are not happy with his, you know, very positive depiction. But mm-hmm. I'll just say, I think the movie, I don't know to the degree that it's accurate, but the movie is, I would say, was very inspiring and positive and very well made. So,
all right.
Yeah, check it out.
I mean, we need to do a Madam Bill at the movies.
I'd watch. I'll tell you what you don't want to see. There's some movie about C.S. Lewis that I took the kids to see.
A documentary?
What's that?
A documentary?
Yeah. It's not a documentary. It's actually acted out.
Okay. Docudrama.
Yeah. Don't go see that.
Because it's bad, or because it did not portray C.S. Lewis in a way that you liked?
No, it's just not that good. It's just not that well done. It's basically it should have been a play. Like, there's a lot of scenes where they're kind of breaking the fourth wall. And it's the whole point of it is about C.S. Lewis becoming a Christian. And like, he starts off, you know, like being an atheist and like, and then his conversion. But like, there's nothing about him writing like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe or anything that you might like. There's nothing that you would be interested in. I would have liked to have seen that movie, but there's nothing about it. It's not very good.
All right. We'll leave it there. I will see you on Friday in the DM Zoom and next week in the DMZ.
See you then.